finished today, and I'll just email everybody. I'll email to each of you your comments, because I've written the comments in the form of the commenting function on the computer, so the comments are embedded in your own texts. So I'll send them back to you either tonight or tomorrow. And then everyone should get copies of the comments you wrote to on fellow students. Did anybody not get... Daniel, you weren't here last week, right?
Yeah, I didn't speak.
Right.
Should I take pictures?
So you do need to comment on other people's papers, but by the mathematics of everybody distributing two papers, everybody has already gotten two comments. So the way it has to work is if there's two people who have copies of their papers and would like additional comments, they give them to Daniel. Or Daniel, you can just recruit from people you know in the class. Extra. He is desperate. The guy needs to... He's a good guy. He promises he'll write only nice comments. So you recruit two, and then if you can get those to me by Wednesday. All right. Where we were last time was just at the beginning of the specific discussion of the mechanisms of selection, of negative selection, in the capital state that Terborn elaborates. Let me just briefly remind you of the character of this problem and how it's located in what we've been discussing. So, Klaus Offa makes the argument that if we want to establish, that what it means to establish the claim that the state has a class character, the meaning of that idea is that there are attributes of the very form and design of the state which can be described as having a class bias to them. That is, when those attributes are present, certain kinds of things are more likely to happen and other things less likely to happen, and that the likelihood has a class character to it. These attributes of the state generate negative selection. They exclude certain possibilities. Now that's a very interesting kind of argument, to imagine that the form of a social structure, the form of an institution, can make certain things less likely. And that the less likeliness has a systematic class character to it. So there's really a kind of double argument going on here. You can, if you really think about it, you see why this is a difficult argument. You have to make an argument that there's mechanisms that exclude, that make certain things less likely, and an argument that there's a systematic class bias in that fact, so that what's excluded is excluded by virtue of class principles. To call a state a capitalist state is to say that there are formal properties of the state, the way it's organized, which make it less likely that anti-capitalist things, the state will engage in anti-capitalist practices. It makes it less likely that the state will contribute to class challenges. That the state will have this negative selectivity that's in ways that serves the interests of reproducing capitalism. Now that's a much more complicated argument than the instrumentalist argument. The instrumentalist argument about the state is much more straightforward. Why does the state serve the interests of capitalists? Because capitalists are powerful and they see to it that the state serves their interests. They or their henchmen, you know, the capitalist class may hire specialists to see to it that the state does its bidding, but the state acts at the behest of capital. That's the instrumentalist argument. There's plenty of evidence for the instrumentalist argument. To be a structuralist is not to deny the fact that on many policies, in many contexts, powerful actors outside of the state, capitalists in particular, mobilize resources to influence what the state does. if that was the full explanation for why the state serves the interests of capital, then you wouldn't need a theory of the capitalist state. The claim then of structuralist arguments of whatever sort is that that is insufficient. It doesn't give a full account for why the state does what it does. And in particular, the state serves the interests of capital for reasons other than being told to do so by capitalists. And then negative selectivity with a class content to the selectivity is the way that Offie proposes that we think about this. I think Terborn's arguments are very much in line with Offie's more abstract reasoning, but Terborn does the additional work of trying to lay down specific propositions about those formal properties of the state. In that respect, Terborn's book is quite a bold attempt, I think. It's a very ambitious set of arguments about all the different aspects of the state and how they relate to this general problem of class selectivity. Terborn proposes to do that by a comparative analysis. And it's always a twofold comparison. He compares the capitalist form, the character of the way the state is organized in a capitalist state with the feudal state on the one hand, and with at least some conception of a socialist state on the other, where he treats the problem of the socialist state to a significant extent as an empirical question, by looking at the actual properties of states that call themselves socialist states. Now that's the part of the analysis which one might want to take issue with in particular. You could buy the general framework, you could accept many of the empirical claims he makes, and then question whether looking at the Soviet Union in the 1960s and 70s was a relevant case for diagnosing empirical claims about the socialist state. As I said, I think we should bracket that historical question, the empirical one, and mostly just look at the logic of his categories. I then wanted, the next task then was to go through some of Terborn's specific examples as a way of clarifying these ideas. The first aspect that we looked at was the problem of the relationship between the public and the private. By public, we mean the domain of activities in which the state can legitimately intervene, and private refers to the domain of activities that is insulated from the state, that the state is excluded from. And Terborn's basic argument, to give it in its distilled form, was that in feudalism, the public was absorbed into the private. The private domain of the king was the public. In capitalism, there is a much more rigid division between the public and the private, where the private sphere is, with respect to the capitalist state, is particularly defined by private property. Private property being the domain of economic activity from which the state is excluded. The family is another aspect of the private sphere, and that's relevant not so much to the state as a capitalist state, but one might argue to the state as a patriarchal state. Whereas in the socialist state, the private is subordinated to the public. The personal is political, would be a socialist. That's the feminist mantra, but it has a socialist character as well. The private domain of production is of public concern. There is no private sphere of production in a socialist state. The public penetrates and subordinates the private. So in feudalism, the public is subordinated to the private. In capitalism, the public and the private are separate spheres. In socialism, the private is subordinated to the public. Let's turn to another of his formal characteristics. So another problem that every state has is where does it get its resources? States do things, They have armies, they build bridges, they do all sorts of things. States do things. To do things, states need resources. Where do states get their resources? The mechanisms by which states get their resources is a property of the state. That's one way of examining variations across states, is by examining variations in how they get their resources. In feudalism, state revenues come from the private estates of the king. This is, again, simplifying. State revenues come from private royal estates. In capitalism, it comes from taxation of privately generated surplus. And in socialism, it comes from state enterprise. So in socialism, the idea is you have public firms, public economic, publicly organized economic activities. We can call them state enterprises for short.